KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. He doesn't crazy.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner opens up about conflicts with the AMC cable channel, why he's not on Twitter, and how he'll end the iconic series. But first, big drama at Hollywood's most successful studio, Warner Brothers, on the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times, back from his break. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, the destabilization of the most successful studio in film and television in the industry, Warner Brothers, seems to be well underway with recent developments.
Yeah, I think you and I could probably pitch ourselves to any local business school and have a seminar on how not to manage a corporate restructuring. Warner Brothers has now lost two of its top executives, Bruce Rosenblum, who ran the TV group, and Jeff Robinoff, who ran the movie studio.
I guess we should say that Jeff Robinoff is said to be on his way out. It's certainly been reported by me and elsewhere that he is not happy at all. And we'll step back and say that this began when Jeff Bukas, who is the CEO of Time Warner, the parent company of Warner Brothers, decided a couple of years back that he was going to have a bake-off pitting the three top executives, Bruce Rosenblum in TV, Jeff Robinoff in film, and Kevin Sugihara in home entertainment against each other to see who would emerge triumphant and get that top job. Now, Kevin Sugihara got the top job a few months ago. Bruce Rosenblum has now departed. Hugely successful head of a very successful television division with shows like Two and a Half Men and Big Bang Theory. Jeff Robinoff is also riding incredibly high and is said to be negotiating his departure.
Yeah, and this is a guy who not only had all the Dark Knight movies, he supervised some of the Harry Potter films, won the Best Picture last year with Argo, has Inception, The Hangover. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. An incredibly successful studio executive. And I guess whenever you have kind of a corporate restructuring, you have a new boss, it's inevitable you're going to lose somebody. And we don't know yet where Robinoff is going to land, but it incredibly destabilizing, as you mentioned, to a studio that has been remarkably stable and very profitable for a very long time.
Now, Kevin Sugihara, as I said, he comes from home entertainment. He's the only one who has had nothing to do with making and selling TV shows or making and selling movies. He's been in home entertainment, which has been this area where DVDs are declining and they're grasping for new initiatives. I don't think he can point to anything and say, this is a thing that I came up with. It's a huge profit center for Warner Brothers. And yet now, the guy with the lack of creative experience is in the top job. And the two guys who ran these important divisions are out. And as you say, John, it is really an astounding, only time will tell how it turns out, but it just doesn't seem like a fantastic idea.
No, and it also reminds me a little bit of when Michael Eisner forced out Jeffrey Katzenberg and created Disney's, really outside of, you know, they bought Pixar, but created their biggest competitor in DreamWorks. If Robinoff ends up at another studio, it'd be great competition. And Bruce Rosenblum is going to Legendary Entertainment, which has long been aligned with the interests of Warner Brothers. They've been financial partners on any number of movies, including the Hangover movies and the Batman films. And now I think the question is, with Rosenblum running its TV division, does Legendary remain part of the Warner Brothers family, or do they soon become a rival and competitor to the studio as well?
Yeah, so Legendary and the head of Legendary, Thomas Tull, this is a company that brings a lot of financing to movies and is now starting to finance more and more its own stuff. This company, it is known that Thomas Tull had his differences with Jeff Robinoff and with Warner Brothers over various things, from who gets credit for what to how much of a share they got on the last Dark Knight movie. They wanted more, and Warner Brothers would not give it to them, even though they'd been partners on the two earlier movies. So there has been some friction there. Thomas Tull has been meeting with pretty much any studio in town. He's ruled out a couple. I think Universal and maybe Fox are considered possible future partners for Legendary. The departure of Jeff Robinoff, I don't think, will be enough to keep Thomas Tull in the fold at Warner Brothers, but it's possible that it will.
Yeah, both Rosenblum and Rabinoff have deep and longstanding talent relationships, and those are going to be incredibly hard to replace. So even if Warner Brothers is able to find other executives, it's going to take a long time to develop the talent relationships that those two men had.
And John, you know, you said that this reminded you of the situation with Jeffrey Katzenberg in DreamWorks. And Jeffrey Katzenberg was fired from Disney right after he released The Lion King, having revitalized the animation studio. And he set up, as you said, DreamWorks Animation. And now he has just made a new deal that could be really important to helping a company that's definitely had its challenges because of the very few movies that it tends to put out and the few that it can put out every year.
Yeah, DreamWorks Animation has not been thriving, but their new deal is a very interesting deal. It is a deal where they will give 300 hours of programming over the next couple of years to Netflix. DreamWorks estimates it'll bring in about $100 million of revenue this year and maybe as much as $200 million a couple of years out. It's an interesting play because it goes back to kind of the organizing principle of DreamWorks, where they were going to have a television company. It didn't really pan out. So now it's a way to use this new platform of Netflix, 300 hours of programming that will be based not only on DreamWorks Animation titles, but some of the other library catalog stuff that they acquired. So it could be an interesting play, and it could really smooth out DreamWorks' earnings, which are very contingent on a movie hitting, and when it doesn't hit, failing.
Yeah, I mean, they've had big feasts. And then when they had a flop at Christmas with Rise of the Guardians, it was like a big shot to the bottom line and really gets the analysts going about what the roller coaster ride that company is on. And it's interesting that Netflix, you know, they're doing what they do. Here's the money. Go make what you're going to make. You have creative control. And it is a play where, you know, the assumption is that parents of little children are going to Netflix as opposed to maybe Nickelodeon Junior or the Disney Channel, because there it is waiting for you on demand. If DreamWorks Animation can come up with stuff that kids want to watch and parents are okay with, this could be, as you say, a great thing for the company.
Yeah, the key question is if they can come up with it. So even though the deal looks good, DreamWorks has to deliver the content or it's not going to pan out to yield anything.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can join the conversation about Hollywood news on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. Coming up, Matthew Weiner on his battles with the AMC cable channel. Back in 2000, while working as a writer on the Ted Danson sitcom Becker, Matt Weiner wrote a pilot about Madison Avenue admin set in the 1960s. On the basis of that script, Weiner was recruited to write for The Sopranos. When the mob story wound to a close, Weiner couldn't interest HBO in his ad agency pilot, but he found a home for it at the basic cable channel AMC, which was making its first foray into original programming. Mad Men premiered in 2007, introducing the world to John Hamm as Don Draper. Brilliant, enigmatic, haunted.
I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for. You're young, you will get your recognition. And honestly, it is absolutely ridiculous to be 2 years into your career and counting your ideas. Everything to you is an opportunity. And you should be thanking me every morning when you wake up, along with Jesus, for giving you another day.
AMC's gamble on Don Draper paid off handsomely. The show never drew huge ratings, but it made Emmy history by becoming the first and only basic cable series ever to win the Emmy for Best Drama. Mad Men put AMC on the map, and even now, with the show finishing its sixth season, TV critics and fans feverishly deconstruct each episode online, even as the credits roll. Despite all that success, there's been drama behind the scenes on Mad Men from the start. That was one topic of discussion as we met with Matt Weiner in his downtown LA office, a room that could be one of the sets on Mad Men, all mid-century furniture and a well-stocked bar.
We're in my office, and there is a bar here, which actually used to be the bar in Roger Sterling's office at the old Sterling Cooper.
Oh, my goodness,
and,
yes.
In fact, they used to come and take it out and put it on the set whenever we used that, and then they would bring it back to me. I actually would say it looks like an alcoholics bar, except for that they're all full.
So you obviously were on The Sopranos.
Yes.
And I'm not sure, were you there to the bitter end?
I was there the last two seasons of the show, which was really three seasons.
But you were involved with figuring out the end,
yes,
of The
absolutely.
Sopranos. So I wonder whether, I mean, are we absolutely locked in that this is it, season seven?
What do you mean? Because
like, that's the end of Mad Men?
No, you know what? Honestly, I think I'm very much wary of overstaying our welcome. And that has to do not just with the audience's attitude with the show and the old show business axiom of, you know, leave them wanting more, but also because I think that the machinery that tells the story is going to get worn out. And I just feel like every season we do the show, it gets harder. And I don't know if I can sustain it beyond that.
I'm wondering to what degree you've plotted that out and whether you're...
I haven't plotted it out at all. And you're making me extremely anxious about it.
No,
I'm kidding.
But David Chase...
I just finished six.
Did he plot it that way? I mean, was that a really different way of doing things on The Sopranos?
No, you know what? I try and do things the way he did them to some degree. You know, he's a model, and that show was so groundbreaking, and my show would not exist if not for the creative risks that show took, besides him hiring me and letting me have that some of that rub off on me. But what I really liked about what he did, and we do this on the show, is there is a continuing storyline always. And there may seem like there's a continuing storyline over the course of the entire series, and that has to do with the consistency of me and the writing staff and history and the characters. You know, the actors are there. And that is a big part of the consistency. It is a full universe. And like, you have this continuing storyline, but you also have the freedom to do whatever you want to do. So what it means is that there's still room to tell other stories. And you start saying like, okay, well, we've got 14 episodes left or whatever. They're not all going to be this like race to the finish. We're still going to do the show that we wanted to do. So David would come in at the beginning of the season with what was going to happen to Tony's personal life, what would happen to Tony's business life, what would happen to each of the characters, which I'm not always on top of. I just have smidgens and pieces and things like that. I've never been organized enough. And David would take off months and months and months between seasons, which also helped. I never had to do that. But I did it once, and it was involuntary, and I didn't do any work on the show during that time.
Right. Weiner is alluding to the long stretch when he was embroiled in very contentious public negotiations with AMC to lock him up for a fifth, sixth, and ultimately seventh season of Mad Men. The network wanted him to cut each episode by 2 minutes and also wanted to cut the cast. Weiner resisted. He felt that the show deserved more given its importance to AMC.
They were making a lot of money on it, and AMC Networks was about to go public.
Right.
Lionsgate had sold it to Netflix, which was the syndication, which was over $100 million.
Very rich deal.
Very rich deal. They had wrested it away from the BBC and sold it to Sky, and all these things are sort of things, when I say they, I mean it. I don't participate in any of this.
But they're monetizing the heck out of it?
They're monetizing the heck out of it, and then they told me they wanted to cut 2 minutes out of the show and cut the cast, and... I said, I'm not going to do that. I don't need to do the show anymore. And they're like, well, we'll replace you. And I'm like, I hate to say this, but you should do that.
And you truly walked away.
I truly walked away. I was with my children. And the weird thing was, all this kind of happened after a very long delay. And I thought, are they waiting me out? Is this supposed to make me put in a panic so that when they do offer me something, I go, yes, I'll take it. I don't want to lose my baby. But it turned out that they had a plan to not put the show on the air for a year. AMC had this plan. And there was all of this. I remember calling David Chase, and I was like, they wrote these mean things about me. And he goes, Matt, it's millions and millions of dollars. You know when they call it hardball? This is what it is. It's hardball.
So when they come back and say, here's the money, and here's your minutes back, and here's your actors back.
You have to be careful not to gloat. And I wanted to, what I really wanted was, because I'm obsessed with detail, is I really wanted my name cleared. And that was not possible. That was a lesson
they
for me, too.
They couldn't unring the bell.
They couldn't unring the bell. And it actually couldn't be undone to the point that I've, like, had writers come on the staff who don't know the real story.
Well, the real story, though, if I'm understanding
it
correctly.
Doesn't make any sense, I know.
The story is the story. They wanted to cut you, and you didn't want to be cut.
Yes, but that was not the most important part of the story. I don't mind that. That's the truth. The fact that they blamed the delay of the show, the 16th-month delay of the show, on my greed and my obstinance and my ego, when they had made a completely separate corporate decision, and they let people believe that.
They let you dangle in the wind.
They let me take the fall for it.
They wouldn't negotiate.
And no one would listen to me say no. And there was a story to be told about my personality in this, which was my obstinacy about not changing the format of the show.
You mean the length?
The length. Those 2 minutes, I did not know how to make it 2 minutes shorter. I did not think that the answer to fighting the TiVo is adding more commercials. You know, the commercials are there to make a bargain. I've even said this on the show with the audience. You get free entertainment and you just have to watch the commercials. And I always felt like I said to them, you're on cable. They're already paying for the TV. You really shouldn't abuse this relationship. But it's their business. I just said, like, why are you eating a horse that you are riding?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Matthew Weiner, the creator and showrunner of Mad Men. Weiner's public conflict with AMC over his contract in 2011 attracted the notice of Kurt Sutter, the outspoken creator of the FX series Sons of Anarchy. Sutter tweeted his theory that Weiner's 3-year deal, reportedly worth $30 million, had financially starved two other well-regarded AMC shows, Breaking Bad and The Walking Dead. Sutter has since clarified that his issue was with AMC, not with Weiner.
He apologized to you eventually.
Yeah, he did. I mean, you know, honestly.
And he took a Twitter break, I think.
I'm not on Twitter because I don't want to share my impulse.
Yes, well,
thoughts.
He has had that just happen with him.
It's
too,
really
yeah.
What it is. It was completely not true, and he was uninformed, and he now knows that.
Did you communicate with him?
No,
about
I
it?
Didn't communicate with him because I don't have a Twitter, and
were
I don't
you
have
so
a,
unbelievably bugged though.
No, you know what? You kind of gotta love the guy for having a big mouth. You know, I'd say like
we do
80% of what he says is true at the moment he says it, and it's always true to him. And, you know, as a writer, wow, follow that guy around. You got a show. And he's a very good writer, too. But, you know, I was annoyed more than anything that I could not even set him straight. He literally had like 5 facts and had put them together. And the person that he chose to dump it on was me.
Well, I think a lot of people, I just saw a tweet among the people, quite a lot of tweeting with something like, well, this was terrible. And for this, Breaking Bad is off, you know, is going to end.
First of all, I don't compete with Vince. He doesn't compete with me. Awards aside, like, they haven't won the Best Drama Award. They've won a lot of awards. It's a very well-recognized show for the writing, for the acting, for everything. But I don't have a Twitter. I can't. I need 2 of them. I need one just that was just a constant running apology.
Well, people tweet like crazy trying to analyze the latest episode.
Right. I actually have completely withdrawn myself from the public conversation about the show. For my mental health, because
really, can you do that?
I have done it.
So many people say I never read my reviews.
No, I used to, and I read the reviews for the first episode, and then I was like, you know what? I'm going to see if I can sustain this, and it has been so much better for my well-being. The most important part of it is the week-to-week analysis of the show is so different than the analysis of the season. You want to say, but wait, you don't understand this yet. You don't know what it is. And you know what? Don't watch the show if all you want to do is write badly about it or you hate it so much or whatever
there
they feel about it.
There is a sort of a hate-watching culture, not just for your show, but
honestly,
for your show and others, yeah.
All entertainment is not for all people, but there is also an incredible link between the portion of the population that expresses themselves on the internet and Twitter. Their self-esteem is related directly to their quote-unquote intelligence about the entertainment they're watching. And who knows? We have 3.5 million viewers who watch it that night and another 3.5 that are watch it by the next weekend and another 3.5 that buy it on iTunes and eventually get to like 12 or 15 million people that are watching each episode within 2 weeks of when it airs. The amount of people that are commenting on those sites, I think at the most on Mad Men alone is 5,000 people.
After a short break, Weiner on the importance of Emmys. As it happens, the deadline for nominating ballots is June 28th. Do you think Mad Men should snatch back the crown from Homeland? Tell us in the comments section at kcrw.com/thebusiness.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, a show that's won 4 Emmys for Outstanding Drama Series. Last year, it was going for its 5th, but Showtime's Homeland took the prize. Weiner hopes to reclaim the mantle this time around for the 6th and penultimate season of Mad Men. We spoke with him about the Emmy race recently at his downtown office. But first, I was curious how a show that's had storylines revolving around real brands like Lucky Strike, Ocean Spray, and Jaguar handles the practice of product placement, getting brands to pay to appear on screen. Let me ask you quickly about product placement. I mean, sure. I noticed some of the products on the show are no longer products that are in the world. And I don't know if you just said, let's choose this because it's not.
No, I always choose a product because it has a personal relationship to me, the show, or has a thematic benefit. The show is not advertising. It's about advertising.
Do you take product placement, though?
I've tried to. We have tried to in the past. I'm always interested in monetizing the show, quite honestly, and putting a relief on the budget of the show. I have to use something.
I mean, when you use Heinz beans, that still exists.
We have a very aggressive copyright lawyer. And basically what we were told from the beginning when we used the tobacco, as long as you do not mess with their trademark.
Their identity as a brand?
Or their slogan. Or as long as you don't ascribe false properties to them, you can use anything.
When you slam Jaguar because you can do that because they didn't start.
Yes, I can do that because they didn't start. They were notorious. And also,
but you don't have any correspondence where they say, can we use your car? Or they
no,
say, stop
once you do that, you
car.
Can't.
Do you
and
get
you know
cease
what?
And desist?
No, they're smart too. Being mentioned in the environment of the show, even in a negative way, is of value to them. To be in the conversation of a popular show that has an educated, wealthy audience like we have that's extremely desirable to advertisers is a gift to them. I am for sale. The show is for sale if you will agree to these stipulations. You can be on the show if there is a historic context in which for me to put you in the story. You have no say over how you are used. I will mention your competitors because there's no point in being an advertising agency and having that restriction. And you cannot tell people while the show is on the air that you're in the show, because I don't want that fourth wall broken. I don't want to see a whole thing about them winning Jaguar and then see a Jaguar ad in the show.
But you haven't done.
I have done some.
I have done
it over the years. Yeah, I've done a couple of them. They're not what people think they are. We did Heineken beer, which was in one episode. We did some stuff with Pond's Cold Cream, and that was kind of violated. Those rules I told you, they found a loophole and constructed these fake Sterling Cooper ads that were in the middle of the show, and that really bothered me. But I did like it as a product because it was it's from the period. We all saw it on our mother's dresser, and it was all about beauty, and I got to talk about something that I think a lot of what the show is about is appearance. We never did Cadillac. People like, oh, look at the placement. We never did Utz potato chips or pretzels. That was all because I grew up in Baltimore.
Yeah, I'm always trying to figure out which ones are, but I'm
We've
I'm
never
not
done Coca-Cola or Pepsi. We've never done American Airlines, any of that. No, none of those people. It's just too complex. Jaguar, none of it.
But it's just interesting to know how you figure out what you're going
to
do with
it. But I'm always open to it, right. And I always have to use something. I mean, we started with Belgialy lipstick. I wanted Revlon to be involved in the show. I'm like, Charles Revson is like one of the great eccentrics of American business, and I have this lipstick things, and no one, they're like, they didn't know what the show was, they weren't interested in the show, they didn't want to be part of the show, and so I made up my own lipstick, and then I was like, well, now the show's sort of popular, do they want to release a Belgialy lipstick? I'm always interested in that because I love extending the reality of the show.
You had the whole Hilton character.
That was an interesting thing too. That was something that I did, and they actually gave us an endorsement after it had been on the air.
An endorsement as in, we like the way that
was. No, as in giving money to the network for the placement. It was
a retroactive endorsement.
Wow. It was a multi-million dollar ad campaign that I did for them because I was fascinated by Conrad Hilton. But the person who told me about Conrad Hilton worked for Hilton. He gave me the book. He showed me this ad that featured a space station that Hilton had been behind himself. I read his book. I called him back up and I said, I got to figure out a way to do a thing about this man. and the guy was no longer working there. And Hilton was in tremendous financial trouble and was not even spending money on advertising or anything. They were literally consolidating. It was like 2007. It was like preceding a disaster. And I was like, well, what's my stance here? And they're like, he's a public figure. He wrote this book. You can personify him if you want to. And there's a certain, Rockefeller has a little bit of it. There's a certain personality of American businessman that I think is virtuous and also crazy. And I think Don has a lot of that in him, this whole identity issues. They all have these identity issues. A lot of times they're from rural poverty. And Conrad Hilton to me was like, this is going to be the toughest client Don's ever had. He has no boundaries. And he's also going to be Don's dad. And he's going to break his heart. And Josh Weltman, who is involved in a lot, he works in advertising and is a consultant on the show, did a campaign for Hilton, for Don to pitch to Hilton when Hilton said, I don't like this, I wanted the moon. I meant the moon.
Right.
And it was the greatest slogan Hilton's really ever had. So after that was over, they were always kind of fishing around trying to make an arrangement for them. And Hilton was in disarray, especially in their integration or advertising department. And in the end of it, all of a sudden, there was a check given to the show, which is what happens, is and to offset the budget.
Just because?
So no, I think it gave them rights to tell everybody that they had a relationship with us and to exploit something. I think there were like, maybe all the episodes hadn't aired yet.
So let's talk about awards for a sec. You know, last year was Homeland's year, I guess.
That's the headline.
That was the headline. And so you want a recognition for your people. If we won't say for yourself, I'll say for your show,
you know,
and people.
The awards thing is a very strange thing. It is not a motivating factor. It is not why we make the show. And, you know, we've been very lucky to be recognized, especially in an environment. I mean, basic cable, I can't even tell you, like, not part of the TV Academy on some level before we were there. I am most proud that we have been able to sustain the quality this long and that everybody knows that, whether we're winning awards or not. But yeah, you know what I mean? I'd like John Hamm to win an acting award. You know, he's won the Golden Globe, but I'd like him to win an Emmy.
You're not going to sit there and go, eh, I don't care about the awards.
No, it's not true. I wish, you know, I don't read the internet, but I definitely care about the awards. Yeah, I mean, it's a promotional device for the show. And yeah, we're going to try and get it. We're, you know, we won it 4 times. I can't invalidate the entire process all of a sudden and say, like, it's a joke. They yeah. Suddenly, you know, you do feel a little bit like, wow, I guess you don't like us anymore, you know. But also part of it's just longevity, you know. And along with this concept I was talking about promotion, like, yeah, it's time for something new. It's time for something new. Do we need to tell people that we're good still? No. And is there time for new shows to be recognized? Yes. Is there a little bit of a injustice to the fact that I have these incredible actors who have burst on the scene on television? They're not movie stars. They're not Oscar winners. They are just people that you got to know on this show that you'd never heard of for the most part. And now they're part of the American lexicon. That's a prize in itself. But I don't know what to tell you. Maybe I campaigned more for best drama than they have for best actor, but I don't know how you campaign for yourself. I can represent the show. I don't know how you say, like, I'm John Hamm, I want an award. It might be tough.
Matthew Weiner is the creator and showrunner of Mad Men. Thank you for letting us come to your office and talk to you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for coming down. I hope you enjoyed the booze-soaked atmosphere.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.